And our last word in business is pricey pet care. Like other health care costs, the price for keeping Fido and Kitty healthy and happy is rising. Make that soaring. According to the American Pet Products Association, the average dog and cat owner now spend about $650 a year on pet medical care. That's up nearly 50% over the last decade. As with humans, more and more sophisticated and expensive options are available for our pets, complex eye surgeries, cancer treatment, even stem cell procedures.
The CEO of one pet insurance company told the Wall Street Journal that all the innovations in human medicine have come to the vet side, from MRIs and CAT scans to chemotherapy and radiation. The journal also reports that vets are hiking prices because they want to make more money. They may need to pay off big loans from vet school. That's the business news on Morning Edition from NPR News. I'm Steve Inskeep.
And I'm Renee Montagne.
From NPR News, this is All Things Considered. I'm Guy Raz.
And I'm Robert Siegel. A story now about the F word. Actually, the other F word, which is the title of a new documentary film. And we should say here that the other F word is fatherhood. The subtitle of the film is The Coming of Middle Age, and it tells us how a handful of serious punk rock performers have made the transition from rebels to responsible family men. The movie is funny and serious and obscene and sweet. And its director and writer is Andrea Blaugrund-Nevins, who joins us now from our studios in Culver City, California. Welcome, Andrea. Welcome back, Andrea, I should say.
Oh, thank you, Robert.
I should explain that 25 years ago, you were booking interviews for All Things Considered.
That's right.
I guess about 25 years ago, the guys who made this film bet were young and living like there was no tomorrow.
They sure were.
How did this idea to find punk musicians who've turned into devoted fathers, how did this come about?
A dear friend of mine, Kristen Riley, who is now the producer of the film, came to me with a book written by an old high school chum of hers named Jim Lindbergh. And the book he had written was called Punk Rock Dad. And it was what seemed like a really fun oxymoron to jump into. And we did. We went down the punk rock rabbit hole and came out with this movie.
Jim Lindbergh, I say this as if I knew this before 72 hours ago. Jim Lindbergh is from the band Pennywise. Here's a clip of him as he's packing for a long tour.
I've been doing this for 20 years, being a singer for a punk band.
Rock Belt, that's where the magic happens.
Can we get you a different pair?
We have a big album coming out, you know, a lot of touring in front of us.
You got open house at school, I'll be in Myrtle Beach.
Sometimes I'll be here, sometimes I'll be gone.
No, I can't take 20 Barbies. I'll take one.
He's the person we see most of in this film, and he seems to have made the transition pretty well from a wild and crazy young guy to daddy.
He's made it pretty well, but it's been a struggle. It's really hard to go out and yell the band's anthem, F Authority, and then come home and be the ultimate authority in his house.
Yes, we're talking about not just the language of the performance, the look of the performance, the tattoos that go along with being a punk rock musician, the attitude towards society. It's a pretty sharp turn one has to make to start socializing one's children.
It is, but what I discovered in doing this film, and didn't expect at all, I was really just thinking of it more as a potential comedy. What I discovered was that a lot of these guys were really devastated by their own fathers. And when handed a child, suddenly that all came rushing to the forefront, and they felt like they had to truly be there in a way that their parents weren't. And in many ways, that was the reason for the strength of their early rebellion.
Yeah, I have to say that I had actually assumed that a lot of the outrage of punk bands was as much a pose as a statement of what their lives were like. And in fact, you interview a lot of people here who really had horrible upbringings and came from terribly broken families and backgrounds.
They did. And more than that, I think that all of them were, in addition to having been maltreated as children, they were also very sensitive kids and really kind of the poets of their classes. And so they felt that they needed to express the outrage that they were experiencing and in a poetic way, but not your regular sonnet.
Yeah, here's one of my favorite moments of balance in the film. This is it Tim McElrath?
Tim McElrath, yes, indeed.
McElrath,
Rise Against.
The band Rise Against. We hear him playing his song on guitar with his little grade school age daughter, And then it segues to him performing that very song in concert.
You know how it goes? I'll start it.
Now I'm standing on a rooftop, ready to fly.
I think I'm at B. But I could be
wrong.
Now I'm standing on the...
That's all I know.
That's all you know?
I'm standing on a rooftop. I think I'm at the edge. Not the typical song that father and daughter sing together.
No, not at all. But these kids are being raised with some real truths in their lives, and I think it's benefiting all of them.
One tension here is between the aging punk rock musician and his family, but the other tension is between the musician and his fans. For his family, he may have to become a mature daddy, but for the fans, he has to remain the raucous kid out there.
Absolutely. It was one of the things that really struck me in doing the research for this, because I was not a punk rock fan growing up. And what struck me was that with most musical genres, the audience ages with the artist. But in this case, this is really an art form that speaks almost exclusively to rebellious, angry teenagers. And as you're getting older, it becomes kind of ironic to be up there screaming a teenage kind of angst. And a lot of these guys are struggling with how do you stay honest? Because honesty and authenticity is sort of the watchwords of the punk movement.
Yes, there's one of the musicians remarks, there's a bit of the clown playing the kid's birthday party here. Old guys coming in dressed up and making youngsters, teenagers, happy in their anger.
And so when do you call it quits if it's actually still putting bread on the table? And then what do you do if that is your expertise? It's a question they were all asking themselves.
These are bands that somebody says in the documentary that they're not so big that they could do a couple of shows a year and live through their 50s on that income. They've got to get out there. They've got to get out and perform, which means being away from little children.
Exactly. And their coming of age and really having to put food on the table corresponded with the decline of the music industry. So that's one of the things that all of them are dealing with, the fact that they used to be able to put out a record and at least be able to feed the kids off of that. But now with file sharing and the decline in CD sales, they have to get out there to get paid. They have to get ticket sales to get paid.
I won't spoil the end of the film here, but Jim Lindbergh, throughout the movie, has to make a big decision. He reflects on that in a very honest, revealing way about what he's learned. So I wonder what you've learned from making this film about him and the others.
You know, it was something that I was wrestling with, this decision about how much do you work and how much do you try and spend time with your kids. It's such a tremendous pull, I think, on all of us who have children. And I think what I learned is that I have to be there as much as I possibly can.
Of course, this story, one can see it as an extreme, that is, people mm-hmm. who in their youth, which went deep into their 40s, let's say, were out performing raucously, publicly misbehaving, and the question is how do they reconcile that with raising their children? But in a much broader and perhaps less shocking sense, parents have done things in their youth. They've behaved in ways that were young and irresponsible. And it's a general question. How do you reconcile that with the kids you're raising, knowing some things are inevitable, some bad choices are inevitable, but hoping they won't make too many of them?
Exactly. And I think all of us go through a period where we have to reevaluate who we are in the world. We're no longer the person who's rebelling against our parents. And one of the reasons why I wanted to explore this with punk rockers is because I think it's actually much harder for them because their whole identity is involved in being the rebel. And then how do you come home and send your kids to school and make sure they get their homework done? And, you know, I think a lot of these guys are finding it amusing that they have to play the deleted F-word version of their songs in the car for their kids. Otherwise, their kids can't share their art. I think that's very hard.
Well, Andrea, thank you for talking with us about the film.
Thank you for taking the time. I so appreciate it.
That's Andrea Blaugren-Nevins, who is writer and director of the documentary film The Other F-Word. It opens today in New York and on Friday in Los Angeles.
You're listening to All Things Considered from NPR News.
From NPR News, this is All Things Considered. I'm Robert Siegel.
And I'm Guy Raz. The Federal Reserve says the U.S. economy has strengthened a bit in recent months, but don't expect a hiring boom anytime soon. Also, the unemployment rate is expected to remain high for years. Fed policymakers wrapped up a two-day meeting this afternoon without taking any extraordinary new actions to stimulate the economy. Afterward, Fed Chairman Ben Bernanke spoke to reporters, and NPR's Jim Zaroli is here to tell us what he said. Jim, the statement released by the Fed today is more optimistic than the last one in September. What is Bernanke seeing that makes him think things are picking up?
Yeah, he said, you know, household spending is up a bit, so is business investment. He has said before a lot of the problems in the economy this spring were temporary things like the Japanese earthquake and the aftermath of that. Now they've receded, so things are picking up. But he was long-term just more pessimistic than he has been. He says the labor market is a problem. It's not going to, you know, get better very soon.
Jim, Bernanke himself, of course, has been the target of criticism this year over the course of the economy. Did he address that at all?
Yeah, he was actually put on the defensive a lot. He was asked, you know, why things haven't improved more in the economy. He was asked about the growing levels of income inequality in the country, why that was happening. He said something which he has said before, that basically the Fed can't do it all, that the other parts of the government, which I presumably means Congress and the White House, need to take more active steps to create jobs. Here's what he had to say.
Certainly, we are doing our part to try to create more jobs and more opportunities in America. With respect to inequality, I think the best way to address inequality is to create jobs.
Jim, we're of course seeing demonstrations against the financial system all across the country in a lot of cities. I understand that the Fed chairman actually weighed in on Occupy Wall Street.
Yeah, he says he understands the sentiment behind the protests. The economy is very bad. He was asked about the fact that the protesters, a lot of them express anger toward the Fed itself. There's a lot of unhappiness about the role that the Fed played in the 2008 bank bailout, which is still very unpopular. And Bernanke said there are a lot of misperceptions about the bailout. He said a lot of people think it was about propping up salaries for bankers.
That is obviously not the case. What we were doing was trying to protect the financial system in order to prevent a serious collapse of both the financial system and the American economy. We needed to take those steps. If we hadn't taken them, the consequences would have been dire.
But, you know, it's just hard to prove that things would have been worse if the Fed hadn't acted. So I think he's just resigned to the fact that the bank bailout is going to be misunderstood, and it won't be, I guess, up to history to decide whether the right steps were taken.
Finally, Jim, what about the bankruptcy earlier this week of the investment firm MF Global? This was one of the Fed's so-called primary dealers. Did that come up at all?
Yeah, he was asked about that. He said he pointed out that the meltdown of MF Global had happened very fast, which is a sign that the firm was over-leveraged. In other words, it had borrowed too much against its assets to do risky things. So there were clearly some problems with the way it was being run. But he did say several times that, you know, the firm was regulated by other agencies, not the Fed. So he sort of deflected blame a bit.
That's NPR's Jim Zaroli in New York. Jim, thanks.
You're welcome.
Now, health insurance and part-time workers. Walmart recently announced that it won't offer health insurance to new employees who work less than 24 hours a week. That's one of several cutbacks in health care benefits the big employer is making. And it raises this question. With so many Americans settling for part-time work, how common is it to get insurance if you don't work full-time? Well, John Rother is the president of the National Coalition on Healthcare, the NCHC, which advocates a comprehensive health care reform. Welcome to the program.
Thank you.
And let me ask you first, under the Affordable Health Care Act, the big health care law, full-time workers at businesses that employ over 50 people get coverage or their employers pay a penalty. What about part-time workers?
Well, there's no provision to require employers to cover part-time. And the reason, of course, is that with a full coverage costing about $15,000 a year for a family, it's not economic for many employers to cover part-time workers.
I would assume that large companies getting hit up at $15,000 a worker can actually alter the look of their bottom line by withdrawing these benefits or make it look worse if they do offer these benefits. There would be a tremendous incentive to withdraw benefits from people in that case.
Well, that's exactly what's happening. We're seeing health costs becoming a larger and larger expense item for companies, particularly those engaged in international trade, where they're competing against companies that do not have to bear that expense.
Because they're in countries where the government probably bears
exactly,
that expense.
Which is mostly all other countries. So I do think we're going to see this as a trend that's going to continue. And with the coming of the Health Reform Act, then at least people with no employer-based insurance can be insured at an affordable price. But until then, these people are really going to have very, very few options.
And what kind of a share of the workforce are we talking about?
This is a growing part of the workforce. It's not a majority, but it's been very fast growing, especially recently when employers have been trying to cut back on hours to save labor costs.
One question about Walmart. The company was essentially shamed into covering more of its employees just a few years ago. Many Walmart employees were qualifying for Medicaid at the time. This reduction of benefits comes very soon after they were extended. Is it fair to say that Walmart's really getting overwhelmed by the cost of doing this?
Well, I think many employers feel overwhelmed. Costs went up about 9% last year. Oftentimes, revenues didn't come close to matching that. And from the employee point of view, their wages didn't go up 9%. So health costs are taking in a bigger and bigger bite out of both take-home pay and the employer's cash flow.
I know this is a question that you could spend an hour answering, mm-hmm. but what's the nutshell version of why? Why did the cost of health insurance go up by so much?
The first thing I would say is that our reimbursement system, namely fee-for-service, encourages more and more care, even when it's not necessary or sometimes even when it's not productive. So we pay the price because we have more care delivered than often we need.
Well, let's say that I get a new job working 20 hours a week at a Walmart, which means I'm not going to be offered benefits. Mm-hmm. And I do some other odd jobs that carry no mm-hmm. benefits for another 10 or 15 hours a week. What are my options? How do I cover myself or if I have dependents, my dependents?
Well, I don't mean to be flip, but your best option would be to marry somebody who has good health coverage. Because if you don't, there are very few options. Under the Health Reform Act, you will be able to get affordable coverage, but that's not until 2014. And most states today, the only thing that's available for people in the individual market are very high cost, so-called catastrophic policies, not very attractive, very expensive.
Well, John Rother, thank you very much for talking with us.
You're welcome.
So John Rother, who's president of the National Coalition on Healthcare. From monetary policy now to food policy. These days, our food comes through complicated global supply chains. It's a system driven by efficiency. But our next story is about a truly spectacular breakdown in that system. It happened in Asia and didn't affect Americans very much. As Dan Charles with NPR's Planet Money team reports, the failure keeps experts awake at night because they don't know how to keep it from happening again.
This disaster, and it really was a disaster for a lot of people, involves rice. It was the worst crisis involving food prices in half a century. But this one did not start with droughts or a bad harvest. There was plenty of rice in the world. This crisis started with a simple cost-saving decision in India. The Indian government decided to buy more rice for its food distribution programs instead of wheat, because wheat was really expensive. And to make sure there was plenty of cheap rice on hand, they made it illegal for most Indian rice to leave the country. In October 2007, they banned rice exports.
This was the trigger. And we saw it the next day. The next day, prices in Bangkok go up $75 a ton.
Peter Timmer is an economist and one of the world's leading experts on the rice trade. The Indian decision set off a chain of reactions. Each one was perfectly understandable, but altogether they were destructive. The Indian ban on exports meant there was less for other countries to buy. That's why prices shot up. And then people said, if rice is getting more expensive, we need to get our hands on some right now. Even smart economists like Peter Timmer were part of this. He was teaching at Stanford at the time.
I'd gone to Trader Joe's and picked up 6 boxes of rice because I knew it was going to be really expensive in about 2 weeks.
You were a rice hoarder.
I was a rice hoarder. I felt so embarrassed. But it's a perfectly rational thing for individuals to do.
That goes for governments, too. And in the rice business, governments really matter. Rice is so important in Asia, most governments at least try to control prices and how much gets exported. During the first 4 months of 2008, Egypt, Pakistan, and Vietnam all started hoarding their rice crop. So there was still plenty of rice in the world, but there was less for sale. And that put the squeeze on countries like the Philippines. Those countries don't grow enough on their own. They need to go out and buy rice from abroad. Panicky government officials in the Philippines went on TV to tell people to eat less rice. So, of course, people went out and bought more. Prices surged. Now, in a situation like this, if you're in a position of power and you're just looking out for yourself, this is a beautiful time. There's money to be made. This is what happened. The government of the Philippines went on a buying spree with taxpayer money. It bought a lot of rice, all from a state-run company in Vietnam called Vinafood, at super high prices. These were corrupt deals, Peter Timmer says. This is how you line your pockets, buying high-priced rice.
You sign a contract with Vinafood in Saigon. Let's say it's $1,000. Vinafood is able to go back to Vietnamese farmers and pays them $500. So now there's $500 of profit per ton, which you quietly split.
Those deals drove up the price by hundreds of dollars a ton. Rice fever spread from the Philippines across the whole continent.
What happened was people panicked everywhere. In Ho Chi Minh City, for heaven's sakes, the center of the second largest rice exporting surplus in the world, supermarkets and rice markets got cleaned out in 2 days.
During the first 4 months of 2008, the price of a ton of rice on the world market doubled. Then it tripled. In countries that relied on imported rice, people got squeezed hard. Ben Flores, a janitor in the Philippines, says he just had to eat less.
Before that, I used to eat rice every morning. So I really lost weight because of that.
This was just a crazy situation. People were going hungry. Lives were changed. Corrupt officials were getting rich, even though there still was plenty of rice in the world. Two Americans hatched a plot to pop the bubble. Peter Timmer, the economist, and Tom Slayton, who follows rice markets for a living from his home in Alexandria, Virginia.
Peter and I decided we would, quote-unquote, save the rice market.
Tom called me up and said, "Hey, Peter, there's 1.5 million tons of very high-quality rice sitting in Japan, the WTO rice."
WTO as in World Trade Organization. To settle a trade dispute with the U.S., Japan has agreed to take in a lot of American rice that it doesn't really want. That rice just sits in warehouses. Japan is not allowed to export it unless the U.S. says it can. Timmer and Slayton started a lobbying campaign. They said to the U.S., let the Japanese sell this rice, just this once. In mid-May 2008, the U.S. agreed. And that announcement was enough. The price started to drop. By the end of the year, the price had fallen by half. In the end, none of the rice in Japan ever was shipped. The cause of the crisis was psychological, and the solution was too. But real people were hurt. And the fear that produced the crisis is still there. It's fear that the global system for delivering food to people who need it could go crazy again. Dan Charles, NPR News.
Support for Planet Money comes from Ally Bank, offering IRA savings products and a Raise Your Rate 4-year CD. Learn more at allybank.com.
Now to another intractable mess, this one with slightly lower stakes, that is, unless you're a Los Angeles Dodgers fan. All season, one of baseball's marquee franchises has been in limbo. It's been caught up in owner Frank McCourt's nasty divorce, the team's subsequent bankruptcy, and a takeover by Major League Baseball. Well, after a tepid season and plummeting ticket sales, McCourt and the league have agreed to a deal to put the team up for sale, pending approval of a judge. NPR's Mike Pesca has our story.
For the last month, the phrase unprecedented baseball collapse has attached itself to the Boston Red Sox, blowers of a 9-game lead in the race for the playoffs. The Red Sox also sucked attention from Atlanta, which blew an 8.5-game lead in the playoff standings. But the real collapse, well beyond single-year wins and losses, was happening a continent away. An acrimonious divorce between Frank McCourt and his wife laid bare the loose sand upon which the Dodgers rested. Baseball tried to take control from McCourt, who fought back. But as of last night, league and owner agreed one of the most coveted brands in sports would go up for bid. John Moog, an investment banker specializing in sports deals, says the Dodgers brand is strong, but the bottom line was hurt by McCourt's actions.
He has taken streams of revenue, such as the parking lot, such as sponsorship, converted them to cash, and then stripped them out of the franchise. And by doing so, he's robbed the franchise of the streams of revenue that would normally be around for several years, 5 years, 10 years.
Frank McCourt bought the Los Angeles Dodgers for $9 million of his own and $440 million, which were loaned. He increased revenue, but the cash often flowed into his own pockets or the balance sheets of McCourt-owned companies with names like Blue Land Co. However, Michael Rapcook, founder of Sports Value Consulting LLC, says that any deals McCourt made with himself should not affect potential buyers.
That was the same thing that happened with Tom Hicks and with the Texas Rangers, right? So any self-dealings, right hand to left hand, is going to be eliminated.
A couple of years ago, the Texas Rangers, under owner Tom Hicks, were indeed in a similar situation to McCourt's Dodgers, highly leveraged and unable to meet expenses. As embarrassing as the situation was for Hicks in baseball, the franchise was sold, and the Rangers quickly established themselves as a great baseball team, appearing in the World Series the past 2 years. The point is that Dodgers fans needn't despair. Michael Rapcook says baseball's intervention also helped the team's chances.
I need to say only good things to Commissioner Selig for stepping in and handling the Dodgers like he has to prevent a potential meltdown.
That meltdown, in Rapcook's eyes, would have been if McCourt were allowed to sell TV rights, bolstering finances in the short term, but providing no long-term stability. Under that base path not traveled, the team's sale price would have been much lower. But the Dodger brand has taken hits. On opening day this year, a fan was brutally assaulted in the parking lot. And last week, a lawyer for the Dodgers said that a jury might find that the fan bore partial responsibility for the serious brain injuries he suffered. As a legal argument, that's rock solid. As a public relations declaration, it's rock-headed. But the Dodgers do have the likely most valuable player in Matt Kemp, the probable Cy Young Award winner in Clayton Kershaw, 3 Gold Glove winners, a magnificent stadium, and the announcing voice of Vin Scully. Are those assets worth $1 billion or more? That's why they play the sales game. Mike Pesca, NPR News.
You're listening to All Things Considered from NPR News.